It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, environmental advocacy groups in the state are petitioning the federal government to look into water pollution caused in part by manure from dairy farms in Kewaunee County.
First, we're continuing our series of candidate forums today. Earlier in the week, we heard from the candidates running for governor, secretary of state, and the 19th state Senate district seat. And now we turn to Congress, beginning with the state's first congressional district.
The seat is currently held by Congressman Paul Ryan, who was first elected to the position in 1998. We extended an invitation to Congressman Ryan for a candidate forum. He was unable to join us.
So we turn now to his Democratic challenger. Rob Zurbon is a businessman, former Kenosha County Board Supervisor as well, and he joins us by phone. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Rob, we're going to start with a basic question. Why are you running for Congress?
To put it quite succinctly, I'm sure I can do a much better job than Paul Ryan has been doing since 1998. And, we need people to serve in Congress who are going to represent the interests of the first congressional district, and not the interest of one percenters or corporations and industries that, quite frankly, Paul Ryan has received millions of dollars from.
Now, this is your second time running against Congressman Ryan, and you're running in a district that a lot of political observers will say is a lock for the GOP. So with that in mind, what brought you back for another run at the seat?
Well, you know, sometimes it takes more than once or twice to win these congressional seats. And, we had such a good, strong showing in 2012. You know, it was the first time Paul Ryan had been elected with less than 55% of the vote. It was the first time that Paul Ryan lost his home voting ward, his hometown of Janesville, and his home county of Rock. So, Senator Feingold called me the day after the election was over congratulating me. And I had to remind him. I said, "Senator, you know I lost, right?" And he said, "Yes, I do." He said, "But look how good you did." He said, Paul Ryan had every single advantage a person could have had. You know, he was the incumbent. He had all the money he could want. He was the chair of a powerful committee, the Budget Committee, and he was even the VP nominee. And he said, "You've done better than anybody's ever done before." He said, "Please promise me you'll consider running again." Well, it was... It takes a lot out of you when you run for a congressional seat and you dedicate your whole life to it. And it took a little bit of time, but I thought, it was the right thing to do. And I knew the challenges of a midterm. You know, the district is still one of the district's 15% that are considered competitive. It's partisan voting index. It's not even R+3. So, while he has the advantage of incumbency, I'm not sure he's going to be there forever. In fact, I think maybe in 2016 he might launch a presidential campaign. Who knows?
Well, across the board, from state Senate to the United States Congress, elections are coming down, in many cases, to two big issues, that is jobs and the economy. What role do you think Congress can and should play in spurring job creation in Wisconsin and beyond?
Well, Congress has a big role to play in moving our economy forward. They can do things like raise the minimum wage, which a lot of people have been advocating for. Members of Congress advocate for infrastructure spending in their districts with both public and private funds, because if you want to have companies relocate to your district, it better be, attractive and having the right kind of infrastructure that is needed to have the ability to create an environment that's conducive to commerce. You know, good roads, good bridges, well-educated workforce, good schools. These are the kinds of things that congressmen should fight for funding for his district for, which Congressman Ryan hasn't in the past. So, I think there's a lot more that could be done. You know, we've seen a mass exodus of jobs since Congressman Ryan's been in office. You know, the GM plant closed in Janesville. We lost the Chrysler plant here in Kenosha. Thousands of people have lost their jobs to these unfair trade deals that have allowed manufacturing to leave our shores. So we can fight for better trade deals that are, I call them, fair trade deals. It puts American workers on a level playing field with other workers around the world and make sure that they're given a fair shake and have those manufacturing jobs come back.
Now, there's a general sense that the economy has gotten better since the recession, but it's still not at the level that many would like it to be. As a congressman, what would you try to do to accelerate the pace of economic recovery?
Well, you're absolutely right. We have had economic recovery. To give you an example, we're now well below 10% unemployment, which was the peak during the recession. We're below 6% at 5.9% right now. Some of the things that we can do that will help that along is raising the minimum wage and building the middle class from the inside out. And once we get back to full employment with good paying jobs, that'll help keep the economic engine going. Again, some of those jobs could be infrastructure jobs, construction jobs, but those are two primary things that we can do. And I think increasing the minimum wage is a big part of it because, you know, 34% of the federal revenues is generated from payroll taxes, and the more you have, the more money people make, the more they pay into the payroll tax fund, and we get our budget back online as well. I mean, we've done well with that, too. Our deficit spending is down from 9.8% to less than 2.9% this year, which is a good sign. That is lower than the 40-year historical average for deficit spending. And once we get a balanced budget with a balanced approach, we can address our long-term debt, which needs to be taken care of as well. So we're moving in the right direction. But I think, you know, increasing the minimum wage will go a long way to helping us get where we need to be.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the budget. You've cited some positive signs. There are also ongoing concerns about a growing national debt and inability to get the deficit down to manageable levels. What policies would you pursue to get the budget back on track and stable?
Well, look, like I said, we're down to 2.9%, which represents a $486 billion shortfall. And if you look at things like closing tax loopholes just for corporations, that's $182 billion a year. You get rid of the ability for corporations to use tax havens offshore. That's another $150 billion. And then you take subsidies away from profitable industries like just oil and gas is another $50 billion. Well, there's $382 billion right there that is not helping the average hard-working taxpayer here in America. These are corporations who are gaming the system and getting away with bloody murder. We all know GE doesn't pay taxes. Well, why don't they? Well, because of those tax loopholes. Yes, it's true. On the books, the United States has a 35% income tax rate for corporations, but nobody pays it. So, you know, corporations are only contributing 10% of the federal revenues right now. Back in the 1950s, that was 25%. So we need to get back to that kind of a ratio where they pay their fair share. They don't get away with bloody murder by not paying any taxes whatsoever. And we would be in a positive, and then that's how you go about addressing long-term debt. Look, I'm all in favor of tax reform. I'm all for hardworking Americans keeping more in their pocket. But to do that, we need to make sure that the corporations who are benefiting greatly, having record profits, pay their fair share into the pool as well.
So you would concentrate there instead of overall raising taxes?
Correct. I mean, there's a lot of things that just need to be cleaned up and straightened up. And this is actually one area where Congressman Ryan and I agree, that we do need to have responsible tax reform. And while he and I may differ on what responsible tax reform looks like, we do recognize that a lot of these loopholes have to be closed. But what he won't tell you is the loopholes he's going to close would be things like the home mortgage deduction, which Americans, hardworking Americans, rely on to make sure that they're keeping their fair share in their pocket, or possibly the child income tax deduction. So read the fine print between any kind of proposals that you might see.
We're talking right now with Rob Zervon. He's the Democratic candidate running for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District seat, currently held by Paul Ryan. If you've got a question for him or you're wondering where he stands on an issue, you can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Rob Zurbon. He's the Democratic candidate running for Wisconsin's 1st congressional district seat, currently held by Paul Ryan.
We extended an invitation to Congressman Ryan to join us for a forum he was unable to accept. You can join in with your questions for Rob Zurbon at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
And we go to our callers now. We have Diane with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm wondering, Paul Ryan wants to take our Social Security money and give it to the bankers to put in the stock market and charge us fees for changing it around in the stock market. Look at the stock market now going up and down, up and down. How do you stand on that proposal?
Okay, thank you, Diane. And there have been lingering question marks over the subject of Social Security and Medicare. What do you think needs to happen in order for these programs to stay solvent, if you think that's a priority?
Well, you know, obviously protecting the promise that we make to senior citizens is very important to me. And the way that we need to go about making sure that Social Security is there for future generations, I think one of the first steps we need to take is simply scrapping the cap. What I mean by that is anybody who earns over $113,700 stops paying into Social Security. And I think we need to stop that. Anybody, regardless of how much they make, needs to pay into the fund to make sure that Social Security is solvent for future generations of Americans. And that covers a huge portion of the what they look at when they say it's got funding issues. And then we need to consider possibly adjusting the contribution that people pay into Social Security to make sure that it's there. One of the couple of areas that I don't think we should look at is raising the age to qualify for it or reducing the benefits that seniors receive. I think that is going the wrong direction. I know that's something that Congressman Ryan has also considered, along with possibly putting a portion of it into the market. And, you know, we've seen what a bad idea that would have been with the crash and the subsequent recession. More and more senior citizens are relying more and more just on their Social Security for retirement. I know it was the same with my mom. She didn't make a whole lot of money. She struggled to make ends meet and didn't have savings to retire on and didn't have a pension from a company. So her Social Security is essentially all she gets to live on. And, you know, I help her out and, you know, hope that these benefits that are there are enough to make sure that everybody has enough to get by on. So, yeah, we need to do everything we can to protect Social Security.
Well, thank you for the call, Diane. And let's go next to Joe joining us from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I was wondering what your position was in regard to the newly proposed pipeline, oil pipeline coming through Wisconsin.
There's a couple different proposals that are out there. One is for a new pipeline. One's for increasing capacity on existing pipeline. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of getting more and more energy from renewable energy sources and reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and foreign fuels. I think we're missing a huge opportunity by not investing in greener technologies. And, you know, the world's energy consumption is going to shift from fossil fuels to renewable energies, and we need to be a leader in this field and these technologies, because if we're not, somebody else will, and that's why I say it's going to be a missed opportunity. So, look, my activism was rooted in the environment. I got my start locally advocating for the Great Lakes Compact. I got really upset when I saw that BP Amoco was given special permits to dump more and more sludge containing mercuries and other pollutants into Lake Michigan. I mean, this is our drinking water, for God's sakes. That's where I got started in getting active in my community, going door-to-door, making sure that everybody knew why it was so important that we passed the Great Lakes Compact. That led to me serving on the board of directors for the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, and then subsequently serving on county board, county board supervisor here in Kenosha. So I've been active in environmental causes for a long time. I don't support increased capacity through existing pipelines. I think you're creating potential problems, possibly environmental catastrophes that would have very significant consequences in our environment here.
Well, let's move on to another issue to make sure we have time.
Sure.
In recent years, members of Congress, they've shown an inability to work across the aisle. There's been gridlock, an approval rating at historic lows. And as a result, Americans aren't feeling a lot of confidence in Congress right now. And I think what a lot of people want to know is what specifically would you do to change that culture?
Look, I served on the County Board of Supervisors and worked with people. We knew it's a nonpartisan office, but you know who sits on which side of the aisle. And we've worked together to make sure that we got the people's business done here locally, and because you have to. I often tell people, look, good ideas do not come with a party label. And proof of that is in the Affordable Care Act. That was passed with ideas from both parties. If you go back and you look, you'll find that the individual mandate is an idea that came out of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. If you look at the blueprint for the Affordable Care Act, it was Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts. So, you know, I do think that a lot of times they do find compromise. I mean, look at the immigration reform bill that came out of the Senate, was passed with bipartisan support. Unfortunately, I think for very partisan reasons, the House of Representatives didn't take it up. So it is a problem. You have to send people who are willing to recognize the good ideas and willing to negotiate and compromise. You know, I would have voted for the Senate bill on immigration had it come to the floor. I didn't agree with every provision that was in there, but that's what compromise is about, and that's what getting the people's business looks like. So unfortunately, there is a highly partisan environment, but I'm hoping we're starting to see that you need to move past it, move beyond ideology and look at compromise and working together, or else you end up with a 9% or a 13% approval rating.
Well, let's look a little closer to home in our last minutes. You mentioned some challenges to your area. Janesville was hit hard in 2008 when GM began the process of closing the company's plant there. What are some of the issues here at home that you'd focus on as your district's representative?
Well, again, it's making sure that when we add jobs in the 1st Congressional District that they're good-paying jobs, that people who are working 40 hours a week aren't relying on assistance programs to survive. You know, I tell people all the time, I said, I believe the best way to eliminate an assistance program is by eliminating the need for an assistance program. And I think that that means making sure that corporations are paying a living wage. Because if they're not, our tax dollars are literally subsidizing their profits. Because our tax dollars are paying for the assistance programs that their employees have to survive. So nobody should be working 40 hours a week and living in poverty. Corporations need to be paying a living wage. Like heating assistance, housing assistance, food assistance. We pay for these with our tax dollars. If Walmart or McDonald's isn't paying enough for that person to survive without our tax dollars, we're subsidizing their profits, and that practice has got to stop.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Affordable Care Act. Are you happy with that law?
You know, I think it was a great step in the right direction. I tell people all the time that, you know, my position has always been with respect to Medicare and health care is that we need to get to a situation where we have Medicare for all. You know, the Affordable Care Act, I say, was a good step in the right direction because it brought in protections and provisions that people like. They're very popular. You know, young adults can stay on their parents' plan until age 26. It got rid of pre-existing conditions. It removed caps on what insurance companies pay out. And it's gone a long way to controlling costs. And I tell people the reason I support a position of Medicare for all is from my business experience. I was a guy who had $1 million in payroll. I paid $120,000 a year subsidizing my employees' health insurance. During the Bush administration, when they had the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, I saw my premiums going up 10, 12, 18% year after year. It was the single hardest expense for me to be able to try and count and calculate on. So, you know, we all pay into Medicare as employees and as employers. and it's a 1.45% that you pay on your payroll. So for me, having a $1 million payroll, that meant I paid $14,500 per year on $1 million, compared to the $120,000 I was paying for private insurance. So we know from studies that if everybody were into Medicare, the expansion alone and the efficiencies would be so great that the savings would be enough to cover having everybody in it, because we're right now just covering the most expensive section of the population, which is seniors. But if you had the healthier populations and you get those efficiencies from everybody being in it, it's enough to pay for itself. But even if you had to adjust my contribution as an employer, even if you doubled it to $28,000, it would still be a lot less than what I paid in private insurance at $120,000.
And we have to leave it there. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Rob Zirbon, businessman and former Kenosha County Board supervisor. He's a Democratic candidate running for Wisconsin's first congressional district seat.
Coming up after the news, Wisconsin environmental groups are looking to the federal government to resolve concerns over groundwater pollution from dairy farm manure in the state. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a certified Wisconsin game geek shares some great board games for the fall and winter.
First, each year, cattle on Wisconsin farms produce as much manure as the populations of Tokyo and Mexico City combined, according to the DNR's former runoff control chief.
All of that waste has to be managed somehow. Oftentimes, it's spread over farmland as fertilizer. On some Wisconsin farms, it's turned into liquid and sprayed through irrigation systems.
The risk is that this manure can contaminate groundwater with nitrates and bacteria, ultimately posing a public health threat for the people who consume groundwater.
As we just heard in the news, in Kewaunee County, as of June 2013, 31% of wells tested as unsafe due to nitrates or bacteria. State environmental groups point to dairy waste as the culprit, and yesterday a group of them filed a petition to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to investigate the issue.
Here with us now is Elizabeth Wheeler, staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin, one of the groups involved in that petition. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what evidence do you have that Kewaunee County's drinking water has been compromised by dairy farm waste?
There's been a growing body of evidence over the last couple of years that a lot of the wells in Kewaunee County are contaminated with nitrate and bacteria. Recently, some of that data has been pulled together within Kewaunee County itself, and the Land and Water Conservation Department has issued a report that outlines the extent of the contamination. And I think that that is what has led to a growing profile in Kewaunee County about this problem.
And you mentioned the extent of it. Give us a sense of that, if you could.
Sure. So as you mentioned, over 400 wells, the number is escaping me right now, but there are anywhere between 30 and 50% of wells that are contaminated within communities in Kewaunee County. And a lot of those communities, primarily people get their drinking water from groundwater and private drinking water wells that are on their property.
Now, why are you and other environmental groups taking this to the federal government, to the EPA, instead of working more closely with these farms, with the state?
Well, I've been working with a number of partners on this over the last year or so, specifically Midwest Environmental Advocates, Environmental Integrity Project, and we have also worked with local organizations, Midwest Environmental Defense Center, and Kewaunee Cares and the Clean Water Action Council of Northeast Wisconsin. We are all very concerned about the extent of the contamination and the real concerns of the citizens in Kewaunee County. The Kewaunee County Board recently passed in a 20-0 vote a ordinance that's intended to target the most problematic areas and practices in manure spreading in an attempt to abate some of the drinking water contamination. But it doesn't go nearly far enough. I think that the ordinance only covers areas where the depth to bedrock is 20 feet or less. Those are areas that are particularly susceptible to groundwater contamination, but it certainly isn't doesn't cover every area that's susceptible to groundwater contamination. Similarly, that ordinance only covers spreading that happens between January and April when the ground is frozen, but if the ground's not frozen, there still is the possibility that contaminants are entering groundwater.
Are there precedents similar to yours that the EPA could step in and, in fact, do what you're asking?
Yeah, actually, there is a really high-profile case happening right now in Washington State in Yakima Valley. There is a really large concentration of CAFOs there, and those large farms are they're even larger than what we have in Kewaunee County, and EPA has exercised its emergency powers under the Safe Drinking Water Act in Yakima Valley to conduct a study to identify the sources of groundwater contamination and initiate some enforcement actions against the polluters.
Now, the state's Dairy Business Association, this is the main dairy lobby in the state, has said that there could be other reasons, in essence, behind this, not just dairy farm runoff and waste, and that these numbers that you're talking about, they might be misleading. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think as for the numbers being misleading, the data is what it is, and we have the data that we have. And so part of the reason that we thought it would be a good idea for EPA to come in and conduct a study is exactly that, to pinpoint what the sources of contamination are and what the extent of the contamination is. People voluntarily have their wells sampled, and that is the primary source of data that we have on this issue, but we haven't, nobody has gone in and done, you know, real extensive primary research on, you know, what the extent of the contamination is countywide. And I think that one main objective of our petition is to get the EPA to come in and identify what the source of the contamination is.
Now, when it comes to nitrates in the drinking water and bacteria, what are the public health risks? What are the things that drinkers of water could be experiencing?
I think people are very concerned about the public health risks of drinking water and some of the specific problems that are caused by nitrates. There's a symptom called blue baby syndrome, which prevents cells in especially infants and pregnant women to not uptake enough oxygen, and that can be a life-threatening condition. I think bacterial conditions, you know, can often be cause stomach illness and a lot of discomfort and even death if it goes on long enough. I think people are very concerned because there are so many different ways that those bacteria especially can enter your bloodstream and your body. I know we had on the petition, we have one of the exhibits is a letter from a concerned resident of Kewaunee County. And she states, you know, she's concerned about washing her granddaughter's skin knees with the water. And so I think, you know, it touches so many different parts of our lives beyond just drinking and cooking. People are buying bottled water to brush their teeth with. And I think that the potential for contamination and potential for illness is severe.
What is the evidence that this bacteria, these nitrates, and the health concerns, that they're directly linked to dairy manure?
There's a lot of evidence. Some of the most compelling evidence are specific tests that can be done on the types of bacteria that come that can link to that bacteria to cow manure and cow waste as opposed to human waste or other sources of pollution. I think there has been a huge proliferation of intensive agricultural practices in Kewaunee County. Over 75% of the land in Kewaunee County is used for manure spreading and is covered under a nutrient management plan. And there has been a huge increase in the number of dairy cows that are in the county due to higher concentrations of them on specific farms. I think it was pointed out earlier that there are 200 dairy farms in Kewaunee, and 15 of those are designated as CAFOs, which have over 1,000 cows on them. I think the numbers, you know, it's anticipated that those numbers are going up significantly in the next 5 years also.
Now, is this just a concern in Kewaunee County, or is this just sort of a sample test case for you as far as you go forward?
I think that the effects of manure spreading on groundwater is a concern statewide. However, Kewaunee has a very specific type of geology that makes the soil there and the groundwater there particularly susceptible to leaching from fields and to runoff. And that geology called karst geology, it has a very high profile. It's not only in Kewaunee County, but it has been studied extensively in Kewaunee County, and there's a growing body of evidence that that problem, in part due to the karst geology, in part due to the high concentration of CAFOs in Kewaunee County, it has become ripe for EPA action.
And what do you hope the EPA will do?
We've asked EPA to start with a study to identify the sources of the contamination and the extent of the contamination. And then they have a lot of options under federal laws to go in and require remediation, and they could even initiate enforcement actions against polluters if they identify that there's some culpability there.
And when do you expect to know whether the EPA is going to take this up and do what you're hoping?
I'm not sure. I've heard that they are reviewing our petition. We haven't had a follow-up call to talk with them specifically about the timeline for response. The type of study that we're asking them to do could take, you know, months to years, and then we would hope for swift action after the results come in.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Elizabeth Wheeler, staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin. Clean Wisconsin, along with other state environmental advocacy groups, petitioned the EPA yesterday to investigate water pollution from dairy farm manure in Kewaunee County.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, new evidence that singing is good for us.
First, as much as the Wisconsin outdoors may have to offer in the fall and winter, there's going to come a time when the weather forces us indoors. So what do we do for fun?
Well, our next guest has some ideas to share from the world of board games. And you can join in about what board game you would recommend. Call it 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
John Kovalik joins us now. He's a board game designer and illustrator and player. His newest design is called Double Feature. His art is in new releases, including Cash and Guns and Quackadoodle Moo, which is fun to say. John, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, before we get to your specific suggestions today, why play board games?
The social interaction, the fun, the laughter, the mental stimulation, the peer. Also, board games are a terrific value for money. I mean, the replay value is phenomenal if you get a good board game. You'll have people playing the same for years, trying to figure out its subtleties, its strategies, just the sheer fun of it all.
Everyone kind of has different taste in board games, though, right? It's kind of hard sometimes to pick a winner for everybody.
Absolutely. And, you know, what one game might be too light for somebody. Somebody may be looking for more strategy. A game I helped create, Apples to Apples, it went on to be a huge, huge bestseller. Many people don't like it. They don't think it's a game. I think it's a perfect little game, self-contained. But, you know, I go on Amazon. I read the one-star reviews out of fun. But, you know, it's a hugely, hugely popular game. But you cannot please everybody.
Well, it sounds like it's a case where you got to know your audience. And let's say the family's together, the friends. You want something quick and easy, maybe at a holiday or something like that. What do you have for us in that vein?
Okay, two really good games, which are going to be very accessible, very easy, a little out of the ordinary for most people. But they're wonderful games. A game called Quirkle, which is produced by Mindware. Think of it as Scrabble, but using shapes and colors. That makes it sound very simple. It is. It's a very simple game, but these shapes and colors are on little squares, which you start placing. And if you get six of the same shape, six of the same color in a row, you get a Quirkle, you get double points. But it's a marvelous game, really, really highly recommended. The description doesn't do it justice. This is a game that's going to have people just laughing and counting their tiles and having a great time. The second game is called Dixit, D-I-X-I-T. And this is a beautiful, elegant little game. The cards all consist of different abstract paintings. The paintings are magical. They're just marvelous. They don't really show anything very specific. They're almost like a Rorschach test. But everybody's got a hand of these cards. One person is the judge, and they will lay one of their cards face down, and they will give one phrase to describe this. If the phrase is too specific, everybody is going to guess which card is theirs, and you don't get any points. If the phrase is too vague, nobody's going to guess which card is yours, and you get no points. At the same time, after you're hearing the phrase, all of the other players around the table lay down a card of theirs. Again, one of these beautiful little abstract paintings which they think that phrase might describe. If somebody chooses their cards by mistake, then they will get a point. It's been compared to apples to apples. It's actually a very different game. The only similarity is that one person acts as the judge / moderator. But, you know, these two games, Quirkle and Dixit, are just easy enough and fun enough you can pull them out at any family gathering, but they've also got enough game to them that they will satisfy really hardcore gamers. It's just, you know, a break in between some of their more advanced games.
It's a funny thing. I have both of those games at home. I've never played either one of them.
Oh, no!
Yeah, I kind of thought that Quirkle looked like a sort of weird Connect Four, which I like, which you wouldn't think would work against it, but I still haven't played it, but you've kind of sold me on both of these.
It's not anything like Connect Four. It's so straightforward. And Quirkle, I believe, is 2 to 4 players. Honestly, I think if you bought 2 sets, you could probably include more players.
And what about Dixit? How many people can play that one?
Dixit is great. It's 3 to 6 players, so 6 players is a nice party-size game. Quirkle is ages 6 and up, and a lot of people will see like age 6 and up and think that that's much too simple a game. But some of the greatest games are incredibly simple. They'll just have all of these. There'll be so much depth to these games. The replayability is huge. Dixit is ages 8 and up. That said, you know, I've seen 6-year-olds play this and really love the game. Teenagers would love this game. Adults love this game. Both of these games I would pull out at any party.
We're getting board game suggestions from John Kavalik. You can join in with your favorite board game to suggest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, let's kick it up a notch now. We've talked in the past about gateway games, games that take people from, you know, the games that everybody plays to another level of maybe complexity. What do you have for us in that department?
Okay, these are, again, another couple of games, because most people who play games, even though gaming is getting far more popular, most people think of a board game and they just think of these very simple Monopoly, Risk, licensed games. You know, I remember buying the Happy Days game when I was a kid, which had very straightforward gameplay. Both of these next games should be easy enough for anybody, but the gaming concepts are a little more sophisticated. The first is a hugely popular game amongst the hobby games. It's broken into the mainstream. It's called Ticket to Ride. The designer is Alan Moon, and this is produced by Days of Wonder. And this is a marvelous game of building rail lines across the United States in the 1920s. Once you get the core concepts down, it plays really quickly. The rules are very straightforward. It's just a different kind of game. You get these train tickets, which will tell you where you have to, which cities you got to connect. So early on in the game, you can choose a ticket which is going to give you a lot of points, for example, New York to Los Angeles. Or you can try building smaller tickets with shorter routes and go for a lot of little routes. You get points for how many routes you complete. You get points for having the longest track. And it's just, you got these lovely little playing pieces as well. The cards, it's a delightfully design game. The production values are great, and there's just this really nice tactile sense of taking your little plastic train cars and laying them along the track as you're going between New York and Buffalo or Montreal and Sault Ste. Marie. Again, you know, it's going to be the concept. So the first read-through of the rules will be what will hang up, you know, some players. But once you get it down, really, you just pull this out, and it's a fantastic game.
Well, let's get one of our callers in on this. Garrett is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, I wanted to call in and kind of talk about a new card game I've been introduced to called Sentinels of the Multiverse. I was never really, you know, into strategy-heavy games, but a friend brought it up. And it's a blast. It's a card game with, like, knockoff superheroes, and you try to save the world. It's a really fun game.
I like the name. Do you know this one, John?
Yes, I do. It's a fantastic game. It's in a category of games called deck-building games. And so it's a cooperative game. All of the players are superheroes, and you're all going up against the supervillain and the supervillain's minions. So the cards, you shuffle through the card decks. Different players will have different powers trying to attack the supervillain. And it's really a terrific game, and it's very popular in hobby game circles. And I think that fits really nicely into the sort of gateway gaming category. Once you get a game like Sentinels of the Multiverse, there are so many other games out there like that, which, you know, just pop into your local game store, hobby store, and you can find all of these things. But yeah, that is a terrific game.
And in the veins of cooperative games, also on your list today is Forbidden Island.
Yes. Forbidden Island is, and there are a lot of really good cooperative games out there. So these are really terrific games because everybody either wins or loses on their own. Forbidden Island is published by Game Right, and this is 2 to 4 players, ages 10 and up. And essentially, you are all adventurers on an island which is sinking. And the island is composed of various tiles, and the tiles will flood. You flip them over when the tiles flood, and if the tiles flood once again, they're sunk, and that is lost. So the island is slowly disappearing beneath you, and you're trying to grab these 4 treasures and get them back to the helipad and get to the helicopter and get off the island. And so there are a lot of ways to lose this game, but one of the nice features is you can make it easier or more difficult. So if you're starting off, definitely have this on the easy setting until you've played a few times. But this is one of those games which is just riveting to me because as the island starts sinking beneath your team, there's a palpable sense of panic.
It is a tense game. I've played it, yeah.
And again, lovely, lovely pieces, age 10 and up. It's for a long time, I didn't think there were many great cooperative games. And all of a sudden, there are probably 5 or 6 really, really great cooperative games out there on the market. And again, just anybody can play these games. There are often both the Ticket to Ride and Forbidden Island, for example, there are apps you can download for your iPad or smartphone, which can help you learn the game, or there's a wonderful show on the web called Tabletop, which is hosted by Will Wheaton. And this category of game, Will and his guests, I've been on the show, actually, will play through a lot of these games. And that's another really great, if you're not really familiar with this category of game, this kind of slightly more involved game.
We'll leave it there for now. John, we're out of time. I'll share the rest of John's suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page. We've been hearing from John Kovalik, board game designer and illustrator, the author of the Dork Tower comic books.
Coming up, new science says singing in a choir is good for your heart. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.